All right. Welcome, everyone, to another deep dive. Today, we're looking at a case that's especially relevant for any of you out there thinking about criminal appeals. It's Eddie Nichols v. State of Texas, and it gets right to the heart of some pretty heavy ethical questions for lawyers. What happens when you're appointed to represent someone and you really think their appeal is, well, going nowhere?
You hit the nail on the head there. The Nichols case is all about that balancing act. You have your duty to your client, of course, but also, as an officer of the court, you're not supposed to waste everyone's time with appeals that are totally baseless.
So let's break it down. Eddie Nichols, the guy at the center of this case, was on probation, right? And the trial court decided to revoke it. But here's the thing, and this is kind of important. He initially filed his appeal pro se.
Meaning he was representing himself. That's a big deal. It speaks volumes about the situation he was in, trying to navigate the legal system without a lawyer, especially at the appeal stage.
And that makes the later events even more significant, because he eventually did get a court-appointed attorney to handle his appeal. And that's where the trouble really started.
Exactly. You see, this attorney took a look at the case and, after reviewing everything, concluded there was really nothing there, legally speaking. No grounds for a successful appeal. So what did the attorney do? Filed what's known as an Anders brief.
Now, I know we've got a lot of law students listening, so maybe we should explain that a bit. What exactly is an Anders brief, and what's its purpose in the legal world?
Sure thing. An Anders brief, in a nutshell, is a document that a court-appointed lawyer files when they genuinely believe, after a thorough review of the case, that the appeal has absolutely no merit. It's essentially them saying, look, I've looked everywhere, and there's just nothing here that could win this appeal.
So the attorney in Nichols filed this Anders brief, basically declaring the appeal frivolous. But, and this is where it gets interesting, the attorney messed up big time. Missed some pretty crucial steps in the process. What went wrong?
The biggest problem, the one that really tripped things up, was that the attorney never filed a formal motion to withdraw from the case. Filing the Anders brief is only one part of the whole deal. You can't just declare the appeal frivolous and then peace out. There's a specific procedure to follow, and it includes asking the court's permission to withdraw.
Right, and we talked about this a little in the outline, too. There were some other important things Nichols himself wasn't told.
You got it. The attorney failed to inform Nichols about some pretty fundamental rights that he still had, even though his own lawyer thought the appeal was a lost cause. For one, Nichols wasn't given a copy of that Anders brief his attorney had cooked up. He didn't get the chance to see the reasoning laid out there.
Makes sense. So what else was he kept in the dark about?
Well, they also didn't tell him that he had the right to go over the trial record himself. You know, see if maybe he spotted something his attorney had missed. And perhaps most importantly, they didn't let him know that he could still file his own brief with the appeals court, making whatever arguments he thought were worthwhile, regardless of what his lawyer thought.
Wow. Failing to tell him all that seems like a pretty serious oversight. I mean, we're talking about someone's right to appeal here, even if it looks like a long shot. And this takes us to a landmark case, Anders v. California. It's from 1967, but it sounds like Nichols really shows how relevant that old Supreme Court decision still is. Can you remind everyone what Anders is all about and why it matters so much here?
Of course. Nichols is a textbook example of why Anders v. California remains so important. The Supreme Court, back then, recognized that even though lawyers have this ethical duty not to waste the court's time with silly appeals, people who can't afford a lawyer still have a constitutional right to representation throughout the whole appeals process. And the main takeaway from Anders is that we can't just take the lawyer's word for it when they say an appeal is frivolous. There needs to be a system with checks and balances so the defendant isn't denied their right to appeal just because their lawyer doesn't think they'll win.
Okay, so what exactly did Anders do to try and make sure things are fair in that kind of situation? What are the rules that came out of it?
Well, Anders set up a very specific set of steps, mandatory steps, that any lawyer has to follow when they want to withdraw from a case because they think it's frivolous. And these steps are all about making sure the process is transparent and the defendant's rights are protected.
All right, let's go through those steps one by one. What's the first thing a lawyer needs to do?
The very first thing, and this is what the attorney and Nichols missed, is they absolutely have to file a formal motion with the court asking to withdraw as the attorney on the case. This is a clear signal to the court that the lawyer believes there's no basis for the appeal and they want out.
So it's about formally putting it on record. What's next?
The second step is where that Anders brief comes in. But it's not enough to just slap a label on the appeal and call it a day. The brief has to show that the lawyer really did their homework. They have to demonstrate what the court calls a conscientious examination of the entire trial record, looking for any possible issue that could, even if it's a long shot, support the appeal.
So it's not just about their conclusion, it's about showing the court that they did the work to get there.
Exactly. Transparency is key here. And then third, the lawyer has to hand over a copy of this Anders brief to their client. This way, the client can see exactly what the lawyer's reasoning is and why they think the appeal is a dead end.
And then comes that part we were talking about before, making sure the client knows what their options still are.
Right. The fourth step is all about informing the client of their right to look over all the trial documents themselves, the whole record. This gives them the power to form their own opinion and maybe even find some argument their lawyer overlooked. Fifth, and this is a big one for making sure the client's voice is still heard, the lawyer has to tell the client, in no uncertain terms, that they still have the right to file their own brief with the appeals court. This means they can raise any points or arguments they want, even if their lawyer thinks it's pointless. And last but not least, the lawyer has to make sure the client knows they can try for discretionary review, which means asking a higher court to take another look at the case if the first appeal fails.
It's a pretty long list of requirements, all things the lawyer has to do. It really shows that they can't just bail on their client, even if they think the appeal is hopeless.
You're absolutely right. And there's one more layer to this whole Anders process, something that offers even more protection to the defendant. It's the seventh step, and it puts the responsibility on the appeals court itself. Before the court can say, okay, lawyer, you're off the hook, they have to do their own independent review of the whole case. They can't just take the lawyer's word for it that the appeal is frivolous.
So even when a lawyer thinks there's no point to an appeal, the court still steps in as a safeguard. That's a pretty strong safety net.
Absolutely. And that's a really important thing to remember. The court's independent review is a crucial part of making sure the defendant's rights are protected no matter what. It's not just about the lawyer's opinion. The court itself has a duty to make sure that the appeal really and truly has no legal legs to stand on before they let the lawyer walk away.
So let's circle back to Eddie Nichols. What happened in his case since his lawyer kind of botched the whole Anders procedure?
Well, the Texas Court of Appeals didn't mess around. They saw that the attorney failed to follow those Anders procedures, and they said flat out that this was a violation of Eddie Nichols' basic rights. The right to due process, the right to a lawyer during his appeal, those were all compromised. The court was very clear that these Anders steps aren't just suggestions. They're mandatory, and they're there to protect the person appealing.
Okay, but what did the court actually do about it? Did they just throw out Nichols' appeal?
No, they didn't dismiss the appeal entirely. Instead, they told the lawyer, go back and do it right this time. They ordered the attorney to refile the motion to withdraw, and they gave him a deadline 15 days. And this time, the motion had to include an Anders brief that ticked all the boxes, showing he had done that thorough review. Plus, the lawyer had to prove he had actually told Nichols about all his rights, the things we talked about earlier.
Interesting. So even if a lawyer uses the Anders procedure correctly, the court still does their own check. It really emphasizes that the court is there as a backstop, making sure everything is done by the book.
You got it. That's a critical point for anyone working in criminal appeals to understand. That independent review by the court reinforces the idea that the defendant's rights are front and center, even when their own lawyer thinks they don't have a case. It's not just about what the lawyer thinks. The court itself has to be convinced that the appeal is completely without merit before they'll sign off on the lawyer withdrawing.
This whole Nichols case is a great illustration of the tricky situation lawyers can find themselves in, especially in appeals where the defendant can't afford their own lawyer. It's this ethical tightrope walk. On the one hand, they shouldn't clog up the courts with appeals that are doomed to fail. But on the other hand, everyone deserves a lawyer, and they deserve to have their appeal considered properly. How does the Anders procedure, with all its steps and requirements, help strike that balance?
That's precisely what Anders is designed to do, strike that delicate balance. It recognizes that lawyers have a responsibility to be honest with the court and not pursue pointless appeals. But it also acknowledges the fundamental right to counsel, especially for those who can't afford a lawyer on their own. It makes sure that the process is fair, that the defendant knows what's going on, and that they have a real chance to be heard, even if their lawyer thinks their case is weak. Anders gives lawyers a way to withdraw ethically when they believe an appeal has no merit, but only after taking careful steps to ensure that the client's rights haven't been trampled on. And the Nichols case drives home the point that lawyers can't just decide an appeal is frivolous and ditch their client. They have to go through the process meticulously, dotting every I and crossing every T.
So, for our listeners, the future legal minds out there, what are the key takeaways from our deep dive into Eddie Nichols v. State of Texas? What should they really remember about all this?
I'd say there are a few crucial lessons here. First off, following the Anders procedures isn't some optional thing. It's mandatory, both ethically and legally, especially in Texas. And that reflects the broader principles set out by the Supreme Court in Anders v. California, which apply everywhere in the U.S. Second, just because a lawyer has a duty to avoid pointless appeals doesn't mean they can just abandon their client, especially if that client is relying on a court-appointed attorney. There's a process, a very specific legal process, that they have to follow to protect their client's rights. And lastly, remember that the appealed courts have a vital role to play here. They act as a check, doing their own review to make absolutely sure an appeal is truly frivolous before allowing a lawyer to withdraw.
And thinking practically about your future careers, especially if you see yourselves working in public defense or taking on court-appointed appeals, knowing the Anders procedure inside and out is essential. As the Nichols case shows, messing up even one of those steps can cause major delays, legal headaches, and even ethical problems for the lawyer involved.
Couldn't have said it better myself. This isn't just some abstract legal theory we're talking about here. Those are real procedures with real consequences, both for lawyers and their clients.
So as you all continue your legal studies, think about this. How important are these kinds of procedural safeguards in making sure the legal system is fair, especially for people who can't afford their own lawyer and might have what seem like weak appeals? How does the Anders framework, like we saw in Nichols, help make sure that justice is served for everyone, rich or poor, regardless of whether their legal argument seems strong or not? That's the kind of question that's worth pondering as you learn and grow as future lawyers.
I think that's a great note to end on. Those kinds of questions about the balance between efficiency and protecting individual rights are at the heart of what it means to be a good lawyer.
That's all the time we have for today's deep dive. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.